The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, and welcome to the Amelia Gordon Memorial Lecture at the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Carol Rock, and I'm a former board member and longtime supporter of the library. I believe passionately in the mission to provide free access to information for all. As some of you may know, the Free Library is currently working hard to match a very generous $15 million anonymous challenge gift to the Central Library Expansion Project. This expansion project is a transformational endeavor which will not only bring you increased comfort in the new state-of-the-art auditorium, but will also provide all members of the Philadelphia community a much-needed creative and cutting-edge information center that is free and accessible to everyone. All private gifts may be made to the Central Library Expansion Project through May 31st will be matched dollar for dollar. So if there is ever a time to give to this important cause, it is now. Before I introduce our special guest, please take a moment to silence your cell phones. I'd also like to remind you that there will be a book signing immediately following this event in the lobby upstairs, and you will all want to buy this book after hearing from this extraordinarily committed human being. Named The World's Conscience by Time magazine, Jan Egeland is the Director General of the Norwegian Institute of International Affairs, and he is the former United Nations Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs and Emergency Relief Coordinator. During his 25-year in human rights, Egeland participated in numerous peace processes, including the Oslo Accord and the Ottawa Treaty to ban landmines. He is famously known for calling much of the Western world stingy during the 2004 tsunami relief effort, causing a rapid increase in aid. His new book, A Billion Lives, An Eyewitness Report from the Frontlines of Humanity, is an on-the-ground gripping account of Egeland's work in the most dangerous places in the world. It details his leadership in relief efforts, truce negotiations with maniacal warlords, including going eyeball to eyeball with Robert Mugabe, as well as the intervention in situations that were thought by many to be hopeless. It is no surprise that Time magazine selected Jan as one of the 100 most influential people of our time. His calls for action and justice for the First World are based on decades of personal experience on these front lines. Yet despite witnessing the worst of the world's inhumanity and suffering, Jan continues to be hopeful that by working more closely with local governments and civil societies, we will strengthen their capacity for handling crises, combating poverty, and resolving conflict. We are indeed honored to have this visionary here with us tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Jan Egeland.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Caro. Thanks for having me here tonight. For a long time, my professional circle was dictators, guerrilla leaders, generals, warlords, mass murderers. And now I am able to come to places like this and see very nice people like you. And here went my... Oops. Here it comes. What I wanted to do today is try to take you on a tour of what I saw and what I experienced when I was, indeed, as Caro said, the Global Emergency Relief Coordinator. And the impulse, really, to do the book was all of the goodbye interviews when the CNN and the BBC and Al Jazeera and Agence France-Presse all asked me in their final interview before I was leaving, are you depressed and disillusioned or are you very depressed and disillusioned having been all over the world and seen all of these places? And then, of course, I had to tell them, I'm an optimist. I have seen that we succeeded many more times than we failed, that we managed to save lives many more times than we failed in saving lives. There is today 50% more peace and less war than 20 years ago when the Berlin Wall fell. In 1989, when the Cold War ended, there was 10 ongoing genocides. Today, there is one or two. There was at that time 20 million children, imagine 20 million children dying every year from preventable disease or malnutrition. Now it's less than 10 million, according to UNICEF. In short, it is wrong that the world is getting worse. It is getting better for a clear majority of us. However, and here comes the title of the book, tonight 1 billion people will go hungry to bed. 1 billion people will not have had access to safe and clean drinking water. 1 billion people will have to barely survive on less than $1 a day tomorrow. And of course, the difference is not that the number is, the difference between now and before is not that that number is bigger. It has actually gone down, even in a growing world population. There is the first time that it's less than 1 billion on less than a dollar a day. However, that billion knows exactly how well we are off in Europe, in North America, in Japan, in Korea, in Australia, in those islands of prosperity and stability, and they want to have part of that. They also want to have a job, they want to have a future, and if not, they want to move. So the jury is really out. Will they go will they stay to build their countries? Can they stay to build their countries, or will they move? I wanted to show some images from the book because that illustrates, I think, some of the challenges that we now are facing. And perhaps the first one is this image of that met me as I landed on Newark Airport to take the new job on the 19th of August, 2003. And it is the building of the United Nations, just bombed a few hours earlier by a one-ton terrorist bomb and killing my predecessor in the job, Sergio Vieira de Mello, and 22 colleagues, some of them from the humanitarian office I was about to lead. I'm showing that because it was my dramatic start up in the UN, but it also, in a way, illustrates that the challenges are changing dramatically and ruthlessly, and you have to be prepared. And the UN was not prepared for this. Just as I could see when I came to Iraq in May of that year, 1 month after the invasion, and again in October, that the invasion had not prepared for peace. One of the images that stuck was the Red Cross Hospital of Baghdad, which had been built by Norwegian aid money for the mentally ill, who many of them violent mentally ill patients, whom we had been able to get out of prison for care in this hospital. Saddam didn't want to pay any attention to this group. The 1,100 patients there was let out in the streets because the invading soldiers put down the walls and let the looters in and all of the criminal violent patients out in the streets. To me, it was a symbol, this is not going to go well. And in October, of course, in that year, terror showed that there was not even for us, as unarmed humanitarian workers, here we have the meeting with Kofi Annan, where I argue that we should stay. Other UN colleagues said, we leave. The reason I argue we should stay is that, for me, the whole image of able-bodied international aid workers going to the lifeboats and the local women and children stay behind is not the right one. So we tried to stay on. In the end, there were two more bombs, and we had to leave. Okay, that was the sort of the dramatic start. But to frame it even more, I wanted to take you back to where it all started for me in my journey in international work, and that was here in Colombia and Latin America. In high school, when I was 17, I was just waiting for a chance to find a way of getting out to work on the big dramas of our time. Of course, Norway was, I mean, it was too shielded, it was too nice, it was too peaceful, it was too prosperous. The dramas were in Latin America. And one night, a Catholic priest told me, I felt, that he wanted to have Norwegian youth to come and help him in Colombia. I wrote him a letter in my broken school Spanish, and he invited me in. Down there, and we found the cheapest ticket possible to Montreal, Canada. We took a Greyhound to Chicago, bought a second-hand station wagon for $1,000 in 1976, and we drove 30,000 miles from Chicago to Panama. From there, I went on alone and ended up in Colombia, including a full month with this Indian tribe in the jungles called the Motilones. The oldest of this Indian group were in their late 20s. Why? Because my friend, the priest, who came to help them against the oil companies who took their land and the armed groups who tried to drive them off the land, he brought the common cold, and that was a bacillus they had never, ever met, and all of the grown-ups died. I thought that we were clear, this was long before Save the Rainforest was a big thing. We cleared land for them there. It was not possible to be hunting. They were supposed to be farmers. And they were farmers until many years after the guerrillas of Colombia, who were small guerrillas when I was there in the 1970s and who became big guerrilla movements with equally big paramilitary movements, took over the jungle to plant coca and drugs, narcotics. And my Indian Motilones were scattered all over. I came back as an envoy for the UN. I had been the Deputy Foreign Minister of Norway. Everybody knew that I had been involved in these peace processes, and they wanted me to be an envoy to war-torn Colombia. The man in the light blue shirt is Manuel Marulanda. Sure Shot is his nickname. He has been a fighter since 1963 as head of the FARC, this Marxist guerrilla movement. The man in the green fatigue to the right is Raul Reyes, who was killed in Ecuador in the incursion into Ecuador Saturday, 1.5 weeks ago, which nearly brought to war between Ecuador, Colombia, and Venezuela. At that time, we had a peace process going. The FARC could have done a deal with President Pastrana at the time. They were not ready for it. They thought they could do more on the battlefield. Today, I think everybody's regretting that yet again a peaceful solution was not found. I think Colombia just shows that one has to be creative and persistent. And the other one is, of course, the Middle East, where you also have to be creative and persistent. And I describe in the book for the first time the inner story of the Oslo Norwegian channel between Israel and the PLO. You will remember the sensation the Oslo Agreement was. The first Bush administration had initiated the wider Middle East peace process. There were very stale negotiations going on in Madrid, in Washington, and elsewhere. It didn't lead to anything. The back channel in Norway, where the PLO and Israel negotiated directly in secrecy, led to the agreement, which is here initialed at 2 a.m. the night between the 19th and the 20th of August 1993. There were only 20 people present, including the bodyguards of the two sides, and the Norwegian secret police, which is taking the photo. It's being initialed here, and it's officially signed in front of the White House with Bill Clinton as matchmaker, and you have the famous handshake between Arafat and Rabin. Now, why did it go wrong? Well, the counter forces became too strong. In Gaza, Arafat came. He could set up shop. There was a building boom. The whole Palestinian diaspora invested in new homes, in new buildings in Gaza. There was a great deal of optimism. But the two sides did not do what they had promised, and that is irrefutably do all of the things needed to build peace. So Arafat let Hamas and Jihad set up camp on Palestinian soil, from where they did terrorist acts, and even the peace hero, Yitzhak Rabin, let illegal settlements just grow and grow and grow on occupied Palestinian land, which again meant that terror started to build on both sides, and a Jew even killed Rabin himself. And that was, in many ways, the end of it. I think in the Middle East, as elsewhere, we have, perhaps more clearly than in the past, call a spade, really. Speak to the sides, how they are undermining their own security and that of the other side by constantly using military means against each other as neighbors. Here I am in the southern suburbs of Beirut. It's the 23rd of July, 2006. We came, it is in the middle of the fierce war. We could only come in through courtesy of a British military helicopter flying 2 meters above sea level to Beirut. Then we drove into the city and we could see that southern Beirut was heavily bombed. We got a word to our people who were embedded with the Israeli army, humanitarian liaison people, who said that the Israelis guaranteed a four-hour lull in the bombing, and I went to southern Beirut. There I said two things at this precise, improvised press conference. Number one, what we saw there is a violation of international law. This was a residential quarter where tens of thousands of people lived. They all fled. It was wrong. Violation of international law. But also said, Hezbollah sending out a barrage of terror rockets and missiles into Israel from close to many civilian targets was equally wrong. And of course, sending terror missiles is an abhorrent violation of international law. Of course, for me, it was jackpot in bad circumstances because both sides were extremely angry with me and my meetings were cancelled and so on. But I think it helped build pressure to end a spiral of violence which could have gone completely wrong, and we could have had millions of refugees still today. The 1.5 million people who fled, however, could return to South Beirut when there was an agreement to end the violence and the missiles, to have an international force on the ground, and to see that people did return. Now, one thing which I always saw in my time in the UN was that the UN-US relations are crucial, in my view, for both sides. I mean, for the UN to not have a strong, good relations with Washington is nearly paralyzing. But I would also argue it's bad for the US if we're not really working together. Because Iraq was the low point in UN-US relations. But let me mention a few examples of high points, even now of late. In Liberia, one of the worst wars of our generations took place. Child soldiers were specializing in killing each other. Charles Taylor was the abhorrent warlord that ruled that country with terror. A UN force with African and Asian nations in particular, went to Liberia and in the course of those 3-4 years built peace. Today, peace is stable. There is a wonderful, democratically elected president called Ellen Sirleaf Jones. There is economic growth in Liberia. How much did it cost? Well, for the United States, 22% of the $1 billion that this full-scale peace-making operation cost, $220 million. How much is that in Iraq? 10 hours of expenses. So a year in Liberia, 10 hours in Iraq. Or take the tsunami. It was nature at its worst. It was humanity at our best. We woke up on the second day of Christmas, and we found out that in 1 minute, 227,000 people had died in Indonesia, in Sri Lanka, India, Thailand, and elsewhere. The U.S. gave us some of the initial logistical hardware, including, I remember the carrier, Abraham Lincoln, coming in with 50 helicopters. It made it possible for our doctors, our nurses, our relief workers to get in all over Aceh very fast. Nobody died from lack of food, medical supplies, for lack of relief. Nobody, in the end, everybody even got their houses and their infrastructure rebuilt. Bill Clinton became our envoy for helping get these nations to work together. And we succeeded. Or take northern Pakistan. I came in October 2005 on day 4 of the earthquake. 3.3 million people had become homeless in the course of seconds. This is, as you will see in the distance, the Himalaya Mountains. Winter was coming in 4 weeks. All other previous generations would have said, let's see how many will survive. We will know when spring comes. In our generation, we said, how many? We just noted we needed 100 helicopters. We needed shelter for 2 to 3 million people. And I would say we succeeded. Pakistan, with the international community, succeeded. And next spring, in May, we had a nutritional survey, a health survey, and a mortality survey, and we could see no change compared to a normal year. There was one notable change. There were more women, or rather girls, in school than in an average winter in Kashmir, very Muslim community. Now, this is when we have the international attention. But the world is very unpredictable. And still, we're bad when there is no attention, when we forget the place, and we have neglect. And I could have taken now Eastern Congo, but let me take another part of non-English-speaking Africa, which is Côte d'Ivoire, Ivory Coast. I don't think many here would know that our headquarters were as much, destroyed by terrorism in Giglo, Western Ivory Coast, as in Baghdad. It didn't make any headlines anywhere. These were the thugs of the presidential party, the Jeune Patriote, who drove away the minority people, Burkinabe people, plus all those who helped them, the humanitarians, and even the peacekeepers from a lightly armed UN force. So here I came inspecting our old office, and then I went out to the refugees, the displaced Burkinabe people who had gone to what was a school where they lived, thousands just out in the open. I tried to tell them, I come from the international community, we will try to help you, and please be aware that we're bringing relief consignments today, and more will come if we can get through tomorrow. One of them afterwards, the spokesman for the women, said very quietly, but listen, you must know that it will be looted. The gangs will come back tonight when you leave. They will loot everything. They will rape the women. They will abduct some of our young men, and they may kill them. We need protection. We don't need more blankets. We need protection. Exactly the same were the message from the Darfurian refugees here in eastern Chad. This is June 2004. It is 4 months after, 3 months after I finally got into the Security Council to sound the alarm, and we got world media to wake up. Already in November of the previous year, had I called it the most rapidly building humanitarian crisis in the world, nobody cared. Not even my own country, Norway, heavily involved in Sudan, nor the United States, nor the United Kingdom at the time. When we finally got the world to wake up, including the Security Council, what happened was emergency relief, generously provided to a very large degree from the United States. That gave us virtually all the food. And little by little, an army of relief workers came. But what did not happen was a peace process. And there was enormous forces at play in Darfur. These are the Masalit sheikhs. They came to confront me when I was there on my humanitarian mission, full of anger, because they felt that they, who are rightly portrayed, many of them as bad guys, many of them have formed part of the so-called Janjaweed militia, they say, we're victims. Our sheep, our cattle, our camels die from climate change, from the dry lands being bigger and bigger, and because the others, the farmers, take our land. Why do you only give them assistance? The world never really sat on the government, the rebels, the Masalits and others and said, here is a political plan for how you will live together and we will hold your leaders accountable to not use violence against each other and we will help you in this desert survive difficult times. No political response and no security. Only band-aids on what was a man-made crisis. I remember a particular meeting, this widow with two young children. I mean, there were many, many cases like this. But we found her and her children in one health post where we had heard rumors that survivors from the village Sirba had come. Sirba was a famous case of a village that had asked for protection from the government and from the African Union observer force, but didn't get it. And one night, the lady told me, they came. Two men broke down the door, came in to her one-room hut, put the guns to the children and said, we will shoot unless you give us money. She cries and say, I have no money, I'm a poor widow. So they shoot. The children miraculously survives bullet through neck, bullet in head, because they're brought by the sheikhs to this health post with doctors from the same government that has given guns to these men, save their lives with UN medicines. You know, to me, this is how it cannot continue. Because it is wrong, as some believe, that nobody is doing anything in Darfur. There are 12,000 relief workers. 2 million tons of food have been distributed. But it is the safe areas of Bosnia all over again, you know, before Srebrenica. We keep people alive until they're killed. There has to be protection and there has to be political solutions. We can, of course, now move all over the world with our logistical means. I mean, this is the time of great opportunity. I could go in this helicopter to meet this warlord. His name is Joseph Kony, the man to the far right. He leads the Lord's Resistance Army, which is arguably among the worst terrorist movements in the world. They have kidnapped 20,000 children from northern Uganda, and they have proven that terror can be ruthlessly effective because they turn the children, terrorize the children, into fighting their own people, torching their own villages to prove to them that they now have no home to return to. They only have the movement. I went there to confront these leaders, the one with the self-made Soviet general's insignia. He's called Vincent Otte. He was killed by Joseph Kony a few months after this meeting we had. I'm telling now Kony and his deputy that we know exactly what you've been doing. We're watching you. We're following you. You cannot continue. We will be able to bring you to justice. However, if you stop looting for food, pillaging for food, we will give you food for your soldiers. If you assemble in two assembly points, that had been agreed in the peace process that South Sudan was undertaking. And since that time, there hasn't been one massacre, there hasn't been one attack, and hundreds of thousands of people return now to their homes for the first time, of the 2 million people who were displaced, and many of the children are returning. Hopefully, Joseph Kony will be caught and brought to the International Criminal Court, where he has an arrest order. Now, finally, how then do we in the future deal with all of these leaders who are doing so much bad things and seem to be getting away with it? Well, I think one of the basic lessons is that we must stop in having the wrong nations leading the right course in the wrong manner at the wrong time. To put it differently, I met Mugabe and had an enormous clash. I feel it is necessary that the UN, the African Union, tell the world and tell the leaders what they're doing, what is the truth. But we cannot force Mugabe to do anything he doesn't want. South Africa can. The African leaders surrounding him can. Britain, who was behind once the despicable racist regime in Rhodesia that Mugabe was a liberation hero against, cannot tell him anything. And they are now leading the international campaign, which makes it very difficult for South Africa to really do the right thing, because then they would be siding up with those who once was behind apartheid. It is a little bit like the West taking so strongly on Darfur that they were letting China and India and the Arab countries, who could effectively have put leverage on Sudan, got off the hook. Just like a lot of Europeans are freelancing in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, condemning this side and that side, they will not have effective leverage in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. In my view, only the United States have this historic opportunity and mission to consistently, and not only in the last year of every presidency, do work for peace between Israelis and Palestinians. Only then can we here, in the Security Council, where people like me come again and again and basically have an opportunity now to tell the truth as it is, only then can we get effective, predictable action from world leaders. I remain, then, an optimist. I mean, I try to list all of these things that have gone in the right direction. Let me just say also, again, why I think this generation that I'm now meeting as I speak to large student groups in the United States at the moment on both coasts and so on, why can they really change it? For three reasons. Number one, we have never had bigger public and private resources at our hand. I mean, we're now, for heaven's sake, we're 2 billion rich people now in the world. There are 50 rich countries, not five, as one could argue they were, 30 years ago. It's 50. Secondly, there is new technology like never before. We can communicate, we can move, we can be there, we can change dramatically for good. And thirdly, we've never had, in my view, better tools at hand. the non-governmental organizations, the governmental organizations, and the intergovernmental organizations like the UN never been more effective, which has been proven in all of these African conflicts, for example, that have ended in recent years. So the sky is the limit. It is a question of political will. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jan. We'll start, for those of you who are new, let me just give you a brief tour. Raise your hand, we'll get a mic to you, and we'll start four rows back. Morris, gentleman with his hand.
Two-part question. One, talk a little bit about the BRIC nations, Brazil, Russia, India, China, Korea, particularly China, in terms of their involvement in the UN and their using their increased economic power for good or bad relative to Africa and other areas where they have leverage. And the second is, why did the UN permit the United Kingdom to take the lead relative to Mugabe? Why wasn't pressure brought on South Africa or other African nations to assume the leadership?
On the first one, I mean, I think it's a key issue to realize that the world is becoming multipolar. And we've gone from the bipolar world, the U.S. Soviet Union, to a unipolar world, the United States alone, to a multipolar world, where clearly China and India are becoming economic superpowers. It's you know, 1.3 billion people with 10% economic growth. It's only a question before they really are superpowers. And they are buying up, and that's to your answer, discussed with colleagues here just before the meeting, they're buying up large parts of Africa, the forests, the mines, everything. What's bad? Well, it's happening very fast, and Africa may need those natural resources for their own young, growing population. But there are also good things. One is, I mean, China is building more roads, railroads, airports, than any other nation in Africa. And it is leading to economic growth. There is 8-9% economic growth in many African countries at the moment. And it's not realized. However, we are letting many of these BRIC nations, as you say, I mean, the emerging powers, we're letting them off the hook. They can play superpower in the morning and then a poor developing country in the afternoon when Darfur comes up. They should be held accountable for what happened in Darfur more than the West. So in a way, instead of specializing in Europe and elsewhere, but what should Bush be doing in Darfur? We should have said, what should China be doing, and how can we leverage them? There are many ways of leveraging, whether it's talking to them in the context of the Olympics, or it is divesting from companies of theirs, which are going full steam into Sudan and not thinking of any of the consequences it has for human rights and the like. Why did we allow then the Brits to take the lead on Zimbabwe? Well, the UN doesn't play. Maybe I wish we could tell leaders what to say or not to say. I mean, I wish I could tell Bush what to say or not to say. I cannot, because they are independent nations. I'm of course among those who think we can use more the pulpit, might one now, as UN people, and sort of tell nation states, play the orchestra, say, shut up, you take the lead. I wish you could. We cannot, because these are independent countries. And in the ideal world, the Secretary General would be leading the orchestra and saying, okay, US, you go for Israel, Palestine, China, you put the squeeze on Sudan, South Africa, you put the squeeze on Zimbabwe.
Jan, who puts the squeeze on Afghanistan?
Afghanistan, it has to be a regional effort. It's not going well in Pakistan. I mean, here you're understandably very concerned with Iraq. And many are happy with the decline in massacres in Iraq. In Afghanistan, it's not going well. And it is because of what is happening in Pakistan, what is happening in Iran, what is happening in the region, what is happening with the drugs, which are exploding after the Western invasion and overturn of Taliban. In my view, in all of these, in Iraq, Afghanistan, it's only a regional process where, again, you play the orchestra and you leverage on all of the parties to behave. Only then can you pull ahead in the right direction.
Another question in the fourth row here. Lady with her hand up.
Thank you. Mr. Eglin, you showed a picture of Beirut, and my thoughts are that the Israeli-Lebanon war resulted from a cross-border incursion and the kidnapping of Israeli soldiers. And your picture showed Beirut being bombed. I've seen similar pictures of Israeli civilian centers being bombed, and you also stated that civilian centers were being targeted. Well, I've seen Israeli civilian centers being targeted because Hezbollah puts their rifle launchers in the middle of civilian territory. Would you comment on that for me, please?
No, indeed. I mean, I tried to say exactly that. I mean, yes, it started by Hezbollah incursion, then an Israeli response, then Hezbollah missiles, then a bigger Israeli response, then more missiles, then heavy bombing of all infrastructure in all of southern Lebanon, plus an invasion. So, you're right. It was both sides. And who started? Hezbollah started. Hezbollah started it. But, of course, Israel, where I have studied, where I have so many friends, did again the historic mistake of going overboard in military retaliation so that Hezbollah, which was very unpopular with the Christians, the Druze, the Sunnis, I mean the Hezbollah is Shia, they became the heroes of all of Lebanon. It was amazing to see how all of Lebanon became enraged with Israel. So again, the policy seen from the security interests of Israel was counterproductive. Just like, in my view, it is counterproductive every time there is one Katusha homemade missile into Israel, which is terror, pure terror. There is, you know, every time there are 10, there are 100 back, and then there are 16 and so on, which means that, you know, in the end, but I see you feel very strongly, so do I, for Israeli security, but of course, seen from the Gaza side, you have to see also from the other side. There are many more Palestinian children now dead than Israelis, soldiers, grown-ups, children, and so on the other side. And from their side, it's seen as the proportionate response, and the lines of new terrorists are around the corner, which is bad for Israeli security. So the only way is now to find back to how can we live together as neighbors. It's the only way. And then it would take great leaders like Rabin to say, you know, we have to make historic kind of a compromise and build hope for youngsters on both sides. But, I mean, I don't believe that. I have seen, I mean, Hezbollah, believe me, do not like me. They think I was the one who coined cowardly blending into the civilian population, and there was 52,000 hits on Google after I did that, went all over the world. and they hated me. They were nearly came after me with their Kalashnikovs when they saw.
Gentleman on the aisle about eight rows back.
I started to read your book at chapter 2, where you were talking about the bombing of the UN mission in Baghdad. And there are some who believe that the way out for the U.S. at this point, rather than just abruptly leaving, is to look at the possibility of a U.N. brokered or other multinational stability force, or that the U.N. could have other roles to play in brokering some kind of a new political compact in Iraq to solve it. And I wondered if you had sufficient familiarity with, I take it you do, with U.N. peacekeeping keeping abilities. Is that something that's physically possible for the U.N. at this point to try and do that?
Well, there is also a big debate whether could the U.N. take over also in Afghanistan, which has many of the same problems. I mean, if NATO West is you know bombing and fighting in a Islamic tribal community, little by little you will get the population against you. I mean, it doesn't look good. I mean, I often tell my own people, you know, in Western rural Norway 100 years ago, and there would come a lot of, you know, Iranis with and others with turban and big beards and food we didn't understand and religious things, you wouldn't like it. No, we wouldn't like it at all. I mean, it feels very alien. Actually, in Afghanistan, still the foreign forces are relatively popular, but every year now their popularity decreases. But I'll be very honest with you, the UN is not even close to have the command and control system for that kind of warfare, which is happening in Iraq or happening in Afghanistan. We have a command, the UN has a command and control system for peacekeeping missions, more like you have in the Congo and so on, which is very effective, Liberia. What will happen longer term, however, is that the U.S. gradually has to hand over more in Afghanistan, in Iraq, to regional, international, UN-style umbrellas, where others might come in and de-Westernize it more. And that is the way out. But I, for one, wouldn't be able to say whether it is, when is the good time to pull out UN forces now. I can safely say that it was very wrong to send them in the first place to Iraq, not to Iraq. Now it is a tough one. Very strong forces are at play, and they can be unleashed very, very easily. One of the reasons there are much less massacres is that the ethnic engineering, as it's called there, has happened. Shias do not have many Sunni neighbors and vice versa anymore. They fled. 4 million people have fled from their homes in Iraq. But those forces can easily come out again if they go after oil and after each other again.
Folks, we have time for just one more question. The lady on the aisle here in the scarf.
The former Darfur conference and the one that's being planned now, and
which conference?
The Darfur conference, the UN, and whether the United States rightly should be hesitant as to put its imprimatur on them. From what I read, they're really nothing more than a conclave of Israel and Jew bashing.
The
Darfur conference? Isn't that a UN? Yes.
For Darfur Sudan?
Yes.
The political efforts to bring peace to Darfur have, to put it mildly, been too little, too late. I describe in my book how I, as a humanitarian leader, I many times said, when we sat in the UN and I sat with all sorts of world leaders and they said, please send even more humanitarian workers. We will throw even more money at you, even more food and so on. I said, listen, shouldn't somebody sending, you know, some mediators, envoys, wake up the parties to respect the ceasefires that they did agree on and which they have routinely violated? Now the UN, Jan Eliasson, Swedish excellent diplomat, whom I know well, together with Salim Salim of the African Union, have tried a number of conferences on Darfur. There is an interesting article in Time magazine now showing that, you know, we've gone from two guerrilla forces to 20 factions. We've gone from, you know, one government sort of arming one, you know, onslaught of militias called the Janjaweed to 100 different ethnic groups, some of them totally out of control for the same government. And I've seen so many times, you know, it's easier for these irresponsible dictators and leaders to say, start loot, pillage, plunder, and rape, than to say, stop pillage, plunder, rape, when it's become a lifestyle for tens of thousands of people. So now it is difficult. The only way, however, is maximum pressure on the government from Asian trading partners, from Arab nations, and from the West, but also on the rebels, and even on those countries who have been harboring and helping the rebel side, because both sides have to stop all of this, and then there has been massive investment in a peace effort for Darfur, which is a war now connected with the war in Chad and with the Central African Republic. It's the biggest war now in Africa, one of the biggest in the world, and one of the three, four major wars still remaining in the world, which is advancing, and where there is, after all, to return to my initial point, 50% more peace and less war now than there was in when the Berlin Wall fell in 1989.
We'll try to remain optimistic. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Always, fortunately, many.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.